the project really impressed upon me the fact that these histories that seem like Mark Twain-esque, if you will, maybe Mark Twain isn't around anymore, but a lot of these stories still are. They're still alive. They're still voting. They're still influencing our culture. And so we have this tendency, just like you said, that we want to just brush them aside and act like they don't exist and they're not valid because they don't use Facebook like we do. But it's not true. Like, they're still relevant. They're still able to, they get on the roads and they drive. They go out and they vote. They call their congressmen. They have grandchildren that they're shaping the lives of.
This is the Angles of Latitude podcast, session number 132 with author, coach, and co-host, Veronica Kieran.
This is squadron leader confirming hostiles inbound. Prepare for battle.
What you're about to hear is the integration of life.
Clarity is power.
If you live each day as if it was your last, someday you'll most certainly be right.
Liberty.
We choose to go to the moon.
It's happening.
And all things geek.
Yeah, I'm not sure I know how to answer that.
You got a badass over here.
Welcome to the Angles of Latitude podcast.
Everyone, welcome back to the show. I'm your host, JC Preston, and thank you again so much for joining me today. If this is the first time you're listening in, this is the show where we bring you life lessons or a message from successful entrepreneurs, experts, and artists to help you find and execute your own personal mission and live a lifestyle that you're proud of. In this particular session, we're speaking with co-host Veronica Kieran. That would indeed make this a silver edition. So besides talking about her journey in writing her book, Stories of Elders, which you can get on Amazon right now, we'll also do a bit of discussing how life has changed since the last time that she was on the show as a guest. In particular, we discuss some of the struggles that she went through as she went from owning a company to becoming her own brand, what triggered her to write her book, and how her perspective about our daily use of technology has changed after talking with members of the Greatest Generation. But before we get to that, I want to tell you guys something about Fizzle. And, you know, speaking of making connections and learning, one of the best ways to have real long-term success is through building a network of people who are going in the same direction as you. And as you guys might know, Veronica is someone I originally met through Fizzle. And really, it's because of her and the other folks that I initially met through there that I was able to not only build my website, but also start this podcast. And as I've said over the years, there's plenty of useful courses in there, but it's nice to have connection and coaching as part of your monthly membership. And on top of that, and this is brand new, guys, they have free website hosting for members provided by Flywheel. So if you already have an existing WordPress site, they'll transfer it free of charge, and you don't have to pay a cent to your hosting people again. And again, this is all still for only $35 a month. So start building your online network, get educated, and get your free hosting today. And as usual, you can get your first month for free by visiting newinceptions.com/FIZZLE. Again, that's newinceptions.com/fizzle. All right, don't forget to subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast listening app. I prefer CastBox these days, as you guys know. But if you're listening through iTunes, leave a review and comment, and I'll be sure to give you a shout-out in a future session. As usual, show notes and show note extras of this conversation can be found at newinceptions.com/132, and I'll be on after the show to fill you in on anything we might have missed. Hey everyone, welcome back to the show. I'm JC Preston, your host today, and I'm actually pretty excited to have you guys joining in. Today we're doing a silver edition today, and if you haven't heard what a silver edition is before, it's basically when a guest comes on for a second time to fill us in on how their business life is going. And in the past, we've heard from people like Clay Green, Layla Ramadian, and others as well. But today we're actually featuring our friend Veronica Kieran, and a lot of things have changed for her since her first appearance back in episode 51. So I thought it would be a good time to chronicle a few of the things that have changed in this particular silver edition. And, you know, Veronica's entrepreneurial journey is a great illustration to show us that You know, our businesses don't have to be static. And in fact, in our previous chat, she was just starting to explore coaching as a business. And today, she has become a bit of a veteran at coaching and has had the opportunity to speak around the country. Also, during recent episodes of the show, you might have heard that she's been talking about working on a book, and that book called Stories of Elders, What the Greatest Generation Knows About Technology That You Don't, is just about to be released on September 30th. This particular book is something she's been working on for several years, and I have to admit, having studied my own genealogy, it's a really fascinating book on the lives of those who have come before us. If you want to check it out before it is released, you can do so by going to storiesofelders.com. And, you know, these are just a few of the things that we're going to be discussing today. So, Veronica, thanks again for taking some time with us, and or thanks again for taking some time with me and to talk about yourself. And I know that's, at least from reading the book, I know that's hard for you to do, but, you know, I've been really looking forward to having this conversation with you.
Thanks, JC. I do have a question.
Yeah.
So when does one get a gold edition interview?
You just did a Layla thing there. I that's a good question.
And then a platinum. I guess
we haven't gotten to that point yet, but yeah.
I bet you will, just because you tend to interview people who are movers and shakers and always have something else going on. But no, it's great to be here, and I'm really excited to have this chat with you.
Yeah, and like I said, I mean, a lot of things have changed, and I'm just really looking forward to chronicling some of the stuff. So again, you know, one of the things that I like to look on these silver editions is, you know, course corrections as a business owner. One of the things that, you know, often gets overlooked, I feel, especially in the online world of entrepreneurship, is that life, you know, simply isn't as perfect as many seem to portray it. And no matter where you're at in your journey, there's still bumps in the road which will make you eventually have to adjust. And in your instance, you've gone from running a website design company to being what many would consider a thought leader. And in fact, you recently burned the bridge by selling that company. And just so everyone is caught up, I mean, why the change? You seem to have had a really good thing going. It was paying the bills, and now not so much. Well, the sell of, but what attracted you to becoming a thought leader?
Yeah, well, I've actually always been on that track. I have always looked up to people who had interesting things to say. It wasn't just that, like, I wanted to be out and talking about stuff just to talk about stuff. I really think that discussing issues within our community and within our society is the best opportunity for growth and change nationwide, globally, et cetera. So I've always been drawn to that. I actually wrote my first book when I was 8. So books were going to be in my life. This was going to be a thing. But what I realized, so I sold that company in spring of this year, in March. And to be frank, the bridge is not burned. My new director actually just messaged me because we got a mysterious package, and it's like a promotional thing from another company, and we're all like, is it a bomb? What is it? We're so excited to find out. And so she's sending me pictures, and we're trying to figure out what's going on. So that's alive and well, but definitely my income is not coming from that anymore. My income is coming from coaching, speaking, and writing. Mm-hmm. What I realized was that I talk a little bit about this in my book. I get pretty vulnerable at one point in my book. I have post-traumatic stress injury. I used to be a disaster relief worker, and I was in the Samoan Islands only a couple days after the tsunami. And one thing led to another. There was more emergencies, and you know, I have this condition. It is the same as PTSD. We're just in the process of recoining it in the professional world because of the way it affects the brain to PTSI. So really, Green Cup, my website development company, was a byproduct of me searching for myself, because I knew I didn't want a corporate life. I knew I didn't want to work for anyone. But I'd always intended to be doing service work. And so I was like, I don't know what to do now. I have skills. I guess I'm going to start this business. And I started several others and a nonprofit, all just searching for myself. And what I finally discovered a couple years ago was that was great and all. It was working. I got really clever about business. I had the knack for it, but it wasn't in line with the original goal to help people. And coaching is much closer to that. It's about the closest I've been to my true identity in a very long time. So that's why I went ahead and sold it and transitioned to being a full-time coach.
Gotcha. So one of the things in doing that is that you're not necessarily hiding behind the name of Green Cup as you once were. You're actually putting your own name on things even your websites, veronicakaren.com. What are some of the things that you've had to learn about going through that specific kind of transition, like putting your name out there first and foremost behind, as opposed to hiding behind a brand?
Yeah, that was a major identity shift. I remember being terrified that I was selling this business, that I was safe in that business. I was safe financially. Like if I had gotten hit by a car, I had a team working, so nothing would have changed financially. And then my face was on it, but it wasn't my name. So you're right. It felt just like a little bit cozier. And I really had to, kind of do some self-talk and identity shifts around that as I stepped away from it. And now everything is under my name. I don't know if there's any specific lessons that I can imbue in that, because honestly, it's just something you have to go through and get used to being more visible. I started a YouTube channel just to force myself out of the nest of invisibility, if you will. So I've done the things I need to do in order to get more visible and get comfortable with being visible, but there's no special sauce for this one.
Well, and I'm glad that you bring up YouTube, because one of the things that as a thought leader you have to do is, you know, get out your message out there in the digital world, especially in today's world. And, you know, I've noticed that you've been reaching out to doing all kinds of things. You're doing workshops, you're doing Facebook Lives, you're co-host on the show. And I remember when I first met you that I practically had to coax you to use Facebook as a true marketing platform. And again, you know, you've managed to not only do all this, you're speaking it around the country. And I guess the question is, out of all these different platforms, which do you feel has been the hardest for you to actually break into?
I have to really think about like my past uncomfortable self. I do actually think that YouTube is a little bit difficult. They've changed a lot of the rules since I was on it. On the personal side, I used to put music up, so now everybody's going to go find all my music. Oh my God. for business, like I noticed that some of the settings aren't the same, that you have to have a higher following count in order to get some of the features. And you really kind of have to stay after it. And now with the book about to drop, I'm not staying after it very well, to be honest. So I think that YouTube is just, it takes more work and then definitely takes more visibility, bravery, if that could be a thing for this conversation.
Right. Well, and I've heard the same thing from several other people, is that the YouTube is just, it's a full-time job almost amongst itself. So yeah, especially with all the, you know, the content. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's content all the time elsewhere, but with YouTube, it's always what's the newest, what's the best right there on the front page. And it's
moment to moment.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So on the other hand, you know, we're talking about new school messaging, but of course there's the old school messaging, which includes doing a book. And you said that you have been a writer since you were 8 years old. Mm-hmm. And you wrote your first novel as a teenager. Mm-hmm. So obviously being an author is old hat for you. And that being said, I see reading as something that a lot of people don't really take the time for as much as they used to. And many times, instead of reading the actual book, we opt to listen to it. I know that you and I we're avid listeners of books. Mm-hmm. To me, this is one noticeable thing that tech has changed for us older millennials and even the Gen Xers. But that all said, why did you opt to go, especially in a documentary way that you made this book? Why did you go for that format?
I am a helpless romantic. So just starting there, This is my first published work, so even though writing is old hat for me, being published is definitely changing things. My degree is in anthropology, so not only do I like romanticize the written word, feel like it's a wonderful way to kind of create a legacy, I also tend to want to go to people for answers. It's my training, but it's also just kind of who I am, which is why I gravitated to that training. And so when I found that I was getting uncomfortable, I was running a tech company and technology was just taking over my life. And even though you had coaxed me some in order to get better at it, you know, you provided some really good advice when I really needed it. I was uncomfortable still, as you knew. So I was uncomfortable. There were articles coming out all the time, and there still are. You know, what is this doing to our children's brains? What is it doing to society, to community, to relationships? We're constantly talking about it. So this isn't something that just like a few people are uncomfortable with. Even those of us who love technology still know that it's kind of doing something. So my instinct was to go to people, and I think that, at least in my opinion, the only people who really have lived long enough to form an opinion about technology and how it's changed things are the people who lived truly without it for almost a lifetime. And so I went to The Greatest Generation nationwide so I could get as well-rounded an American narrative as possible for history, but also for like opinion's sake. Like if I talk to people who are only educated and they had opinions about technology, then we're going to say that is an educational bias, and that doesn't even come close to scratching the surface. So That's why I went so far and wide.
Did you think you would actually do a video documentary in the future?
I knew I wanted that. I didn't know how it was going to come to be. That was one of those like prayers that you let go to the universe and you hope to God something happens. I took that video footage with that hope. And then after I was back from the research, I was working on the manuscript. I met David Astudillo, who is a local documentarian, but watch out, like everybody hold on to your seats because you're going to know about this guy. I'm not joking. And we shook hands at a writer's group. He's actually not a writer. He's a filmmaker, but he went with a friend. And then the next day, he used the card I gave him to email me and said, "Have you considered making your work into a documentary? I would love to be a part of that." Just full of gumption. So the documentary is having its world premiere at the book release party, and I'm so excited. I'm so excited to have that aspect of it.
That's so cool. So, You know, knowing everything that you know right now before we actually get into the book, as far as making it, would there have been any things that you would have changed during the process looking back now?
You know, it's worked. It worked. It worked out fine. I really wanted a support team at home while I was driving across the country. And I tried to put that together, but things kept falling through. So a lot more of the burden fell on me than I had intended while I was driving, interviewing, and then sleeping in Airbnbs or hotels. So that was very stressful. And in the book, that's when I get really honest. I'm like, yeah, my PTSI totally triggered because I was under so much stress. So that I would change, but really the rest of it, I mean, we're here now. It's good. So yeah.
It was still a learning experiment. We'll call it that.
Oh yes. Yes, that is true.
Cool. So moving on to the book itself, again, for those of you who haven't actually read it or don't know the entire story, is that you went around the country traveling to all kinds of different places, talking to members of the Greatest Generation. Really, the whole idea of the book is that you just wanted to understand what they thought about the changes that technology had brought us over the years. And I know that you've done this project because you wanted to find out what they thought, but what was the actual trigger that made you go on this quest? I mean, had you been thinking about doing something like this for a while, wasn't quite sure what the question was, you finally, you know, something hit you, and then you're like, oh, I got to go find out the answer? Or did you, was it more of a something in your life that was kind of a bigger point, and then you're like, ah, I got to do this as soon as possible?
I would say it's a combination, but leaning more towards the former. In February of 2015, I started feeling like I wanted to document our history somehow. The impetus literally was driving down a country road and seeing an old barn and thinking about how there's a movement to save old Michigan barns. And I was like, well, yeah, those are being knocked down. And then once those are knocked down, that's just a way of life that is gone. Maybe I want to document that. And so I was thinking in a photojournalistic manner. And then that evolved. It's just really interesting when you like, your life is not your own sometimes, and you're just following what the muses tell you to do, and you just do it. So I was talking about the project with friends, explaining what I was thinking, and noticing that I was talking a lot about our elders' perspective with regards to these old ways passing away, because like their minds are kind of the keepers of these stories. Barn has no meaning. The barn has no meaning unless there are stories to go with it. And those are the people that know it. So there was that, like, that was the next step in the evolution. And then from there, I started doing a couple interviews with family members who were of that age group, just to kind of like test the concept. So when I was describing those interviews to friends afterwards, what I then noticed was I'm talking a lot about the compare and contrast between their lives then and our lives now with technology. And that's when it finally started to click into place. So then you're talking about, you know, is it something in my own life that kind of kicked it off? The piece that is very specific to my own life, besides the fact that I'm an anthropologist and own a tech company, is that I didn't get to know my grandparents, not very well. My one grandfather died 20 years before I was born. One died a year after I was born. One grandmother began having symptoms of Alzheimer's when I was 10. And the other grandmother lived 4.5 hours away and passed away when I was 19. So that like deep connection that some people are so lucky to have, I didn't. And so I think I felt that loss. I knew what it felt like to not have that when others did. And so that drove this project further to like really save these memories, save these stories, because some people won't get the chance. Many people won't get the chance, actually.
Yeah, I can really relate with that, because let's see, grandfather on that side, grandmother on that side, both had passed by the time that I was born.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, just you have questions that cannot be answered once they're passed. So yeah,
right.
I definitely understand that perspective. How did you actually come up with the list of individuals that you wanted to visit?
Well, I owned a company, and that taught me how to network. And so I just networked. It was a little bit of getting on the phone with people. My contacts from disaster relief are all over the country. And so I just called them up, asking who they know, making a list, gathering phone numbers, building a spreadsheet, asking around within my own community, putting it on social media, found a few through Reddit, and then eventually found a few more through the Kickstarter campaign that I ran in order to fund the whole thing.
Okay. Because I was wondering if you had used your previously built networks to build that, or if you had more or less like, I want to talk to a person that would have done this, because there's a couple of individuals in the book that you, it's like, oh wow, they have a heck of a background. They would know a lot about tech.
Yeah.
And so I was just thinking that, you know, maybe part of that was that you were like, I want to meet people that would have this kind of a background and talk specifically to them. So I wasn't quite sure how that went.
There was one person that I specifically went after, not like as an individual, but I knew I needed a background in the LGBT community, which is hard to find in the greatest generation, because back then you just didn't come out. So I did actually kind of put like a ABP out on the socials and found somebody after the fact.
Cool. Another thing about everything that went on is that you did a Kickstarter campaign that helped you actually finance this expedition of yours. Mm-hmm. Do you feel it was a success? And what would you contribute to it being one if it was?
Yeah. So it's a success in that I reached my goal. I didn't go very far beyond my goal, but that is sort of understandable in my opinion, just because I had never done anything like this before. So there was a leap of faith for anybody who was going to fund it. People who do know me know that I'm stubborn and full of grit, but people who don't know me don't know that, you know? But I call it a success also because it was a staff pick, and you cannot do anything to get that accolade. Staff picks on Kickstarter are where the Kickstarter staff just goes through what is available on Kickstarter on a weekly basis or a bi-weekly basis. It's kind of cloak and dagger, so I don't actually know. And they simply like give out this badge that says, this is a staff pick. We like this. You can't ask them for it. You can't vie for it. It has nothing to do with the amount of followers you have or anything. It is simply, they think this is cool. And so you get the badge, and I got the badge. The rest of it, I attribute my success on Kickstarter to my instinct that I built as a businesswoman. If I don't know something, I go find somebody who does. And so I crowdsourced information from everyone that I knew or from friends who had friends that had done Kickstarters. So I just asked around, who's done a Kickstarter? How did it go? What would you have done differently? What was successful? What was a failure? You know, et cetera. And that's how I knew to export every single one of my Facebook friends onto a spreadsheet and then spend hours every single day during those 30 days messaging each person individually with the link, imploring them, please share this, please support it if you support it. And then that's also where I got the idea, maybe it was just through plain research online. I launched the Kickstarter with a launch party. So I hosted an event. We had, I think maybe 30 people came, and I got local sponsors. So there were prizes for the first 10 people who supported the project. So I made a little speech. I introduced the project. I clicked go live right then and there. And then everyone got out their phones and downloaded the apps and started giving. And those first 10 people got the first pick of the pile, essentially. And we also had fun. We drank a little, so, you know. We had an enjoyable time.
Awesome. Kind of going into the breadth of what the actual book is about. You know, many of us, you know, obviously not us, because we were just talking about the fact that we didn't get to hear as many of the stories as we would have liked to growing up. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people, you know, when they're thinking about the Greatest Generation, you know, they might have grown up hearing stories about, in my day, you had to walk to 2 miles mm-hmm. in the school and the snow, you know, going both ways, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I mean, really, there was a bit of a meme about this before there were memes on the web. And, you know, we really, I think for the most part, a lot of us tend, especially in the Western culture, tend to take our elders' wisdom for granted. And, mm-hmm. you know, when you think about your journey in retrospect, how did the culmination of all the stories change your perspective of where we're at as a culture?
I think, you know, I really count myself as somebody who has paid a lot of attention. I try very hard to be knowledgeable about things. And I was still caught off guard sometimes. The project really impressed upon me the fact that these histories that seem like Mark Twain-esque, if you will, mm-hmm. maybe Mark Twain isn't around anymore, but a lot of these stories still are. They're still alive. They're still voting. They're still influencing our culture. And so, like, we have this tendency, just like you said, that we want to just brush them aside and act like they don't exist and they're not valid because they don't use Facebook like we do. But apparently that's a Brooklyn person, by the way. That was an accent coming out of me. but it's not true. Like, they're still relevant. They're still able to, they get on the roads and they drive. They go out and they vote. They call their congressmen. They have grandchildren that they're shaping the lives of. This is still really important. And then there were just, they're like little bits and pieces throughout that, you know, like I knew things about, but I didn't really, the flesh wasn't on the bone until I did this project. And now I feel like I really have a good understanding of what it was like to grow up in the 1930s, to have that level of community. And I get the nostalgia. I get it viscerally, not just because I would love to have those types of communities, but I've heard so many stories about them.
Yeah. Yeah. To me, two chapters that really stuck out were the ones on communication. And then again, as you were talking about community, and in my own experience, the level of communication that we have today has drastically affected how we engage with people around us. And, you know, it's much easier to stay in a tribe that thinks one way and rejects all the ideas that conflict with those tribes. I mean, it's just we're not talking Seth Godin tribes. We're talking like tribes of thought, like, to the extreme. And many would say that the current political climate is the way it is because of these tribes just pointing fingers at each other and not really working on finding real solutions together. And one of the things that we're doing in Amplify is, you know, creating a safe space for people that all walks of life to come together and actually engage in discussions that they might not have had in the last 10 years or ever.
Which I love.
You know, in fact, last night we actually had a successful event that where one of the speakers was talking about the need for people to get away from their dopamine fixes by, you know, getting off their technology. And in today's seemingly online driven, for lack of a better phrase, world, do you think this is actually possible? And, you know, how can we be more intentional about tech in our day-to-day lives?
I don't know if it's possible to completely exit the world of technology. I think that there will be harm. There's in fact a gentleman that I interviewed that you're probably familiar with because of the book, named Jim Hayes, and he has really intentionally not picked up any technology in his life, but he admits that he feels like, yeah, I'm being left behind. I personally notice that when I have a friend who's not on Facebook, I kind of forget about them, not because I don't love them, but because they're not constantly in my face, you know?
Right.
So what I encourage my entrepreneur clients to do, I tend to work a lot around self-care just as much as I am working to scale their businesses. And so I focus a lot just kind of like paying attention to how they're managing their lifestyle around having a business, because it's definitely easy to start barrel rolling and then you can't stop. And I really encourage entrepreneurs and really anyone to not pick up the phone first thing in the morning, or like not get on technology at all first thing in the morning. Because what it does is basically turns a fire hose on into your brain and you have tons of input right first thing in the morning when your mind isn't awake enough yet to manage it. And it kicks you right into a fight or flight mode. Yeah. And then you start your day in that stress position and the rest of your day is primed by that. So I personally, I turn off my alarm. I still keep my phone with my alarm on. I've tried getting away from having my phone near my bed, but I am the person that people call in an emergency and I would hate to miss that call. So I stick it between the mattress and the box spring. So it's like kind of not in my sleeping space. Turn off the alarm and just leave it there, exit the bedroom and don't go back for it for an hour or two.
One of the things that she was talking about last night was instead of fixating on your phone for the first half an hour to an hour of the day, you know, maybe just let yourself be, you know, get into a meditative like situation where you're just, you know, letting yourself boot up.
Right.
You know, for me, I've found has been the best thing. I mean, I really try not to do, one of the first things I do in the morning is get my coffee going. And then as I'm having that coffee, I'm trying not to do much of anything. Maybe maybe hearing some of the morning news and, you know, hearing what's going on in the world, but nothing that is pressing me into action right now, right away.
Right. Yeah, like imagine our favorite movies, especially the ones that are very tactile, very cinematographic, if we can use that word, if that's correct. When somebody wakes up in the morning in a movie, they don't just sit on their cell phones. That would be a very boring movie. They get up, they stretch, you hear them kind of like sigh a little bit, especially those very artsy movies. You see them scoop coffee grounds into a French press, they boil the water, you hear it pouring in, you see them press it, they're sipping it, they're looking out the window, welcoming the day, and you're just like, yeah, that sounds like a great morning. And then the next thought that most people have is, too bad I only have that on vacation. And like, what? Yeah. That's not the way it has to be. The other thing, so to your point, you said you really felt the chapters on communication and community were important to you. The same thing with movies. We don't see people sitting and chatting on their cell phones back and forth in movies. Not only would that be a boring movie, it wouldn't pull on your heartstrings the way we want movies to do in order to sell tickets. They're usually surrounded by a close-knit group of friends and they're going on adventures. I mean, Sandlot wouldn't be the same if there were smartphones, right? So I watch these movies, I really think and reflect on my own life as best I can and say, okay, like, I love this. This gives me warm feelings, but it's not real. So then how do I make it real?
Dog won't let me get ball, sad face, text. That's hilarious.
Yeah, right? Like scared of old man. Here, let me just go on Amazon and buy another ball.
Yeah, right?
Whole movie over.
There you go. There you go. End of story.
Totally. Wow. Like flippity flapping Converse shoes on the dirt. Wouldn't happen. Let me get another pair on Amazon here in 2 days.
Yeah. Done.
Yeah.
It's crazy to even think about, but mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm. And
oh, mom just pinged me on my phone. I have to come home now. As opposed to just like come home when most of our elders would go by the streetlights if they're in the city. If they weren't in the city, then it's dusk. You need to come home. So like the moment it gets dim in whatever form, you get your butt home. My mom used to blow a whistle across the neighborhood, much to my chagrin. But you didn't just get a text message. They weren't constantly in your pocket. They weren't tracking your location.
Well, and that brings up, I heard a figure that they released that 2018 preliminary statistics say that this is one of the safest years that we've actually had since 1990s.
Yeah.
And, maybe because there is more awareness of what kids are doing and all that sort of stuff. But at the same time, can those kids actually appreciate the fact that it's safe, or is it, are they just kind of going to have to be forever forced to stay on their phones, because you can't, what's the point of having a safe society if you're not actually able to enjoy it? I mean,
right. And live in it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think what scares me and what it seems like scares our elders, they're not anti-tech. I mean, you read the book. They're in awe. They think this is really incredible stuff. Like, holy cow, you can do knee replacements. Holy cow, you can fix my heart and I live 50 years longer than I ever was expected to live, mm-hmm. But to their point, they talk a little bit about it in the book, and then I have personally extrapolated it a little bit further. When you give a 2-year-old a smartphone, their brain vacuums that up. The terrible twos are the terrible twos because they are into everything. It is the moment in time when the brain is the most active. The first cellular die-off has not happened in the brain yet. That happens around age 3. Mm-hmm. And so the brain is basically figuring out, what's the world? What do I need to retain? And what do I need to throw away? So that's why everything goes in the mouth. I need to touch everything. I need to climb on everything. I'm going to jump off of everything, much to my parents' fear. I want to sometimes defecate in different places to see what that's like. They're just doing everything and constantly learning. And so then you take that vacuum state of a brain, and then the only thing that they're vacuuming in is a smartphone. and then the brain cells die off. And then what happens? How does that form our politicians and our educators and our thought leaders in the future if they have the smartphone wired into their heads?
Yeah.
And didn't get the touch of the dirt, didn't get, how do you empathize with somebody if you've never been that dirty? And then there's people in the world who are that dirty every day. So that's why they're scared. They're not like turn off the technology. They're more intentional with it. And we accidentally read it as they can't learn. No, they're just choosing not to have a bing and peep every moment. But they're worried about that. They're worried about our children.
Off the top of your mind, is there any other kinds of major issues that were similar to that, that they're worried about?
I know what I'm worried about. there was the child factor that they would bring up, but then they would extrapolate that further into the communities, into the neighborliness, into the rest of society. Because I think that they're, just as we said before, our elders are kind of isolated and set aside in sad ways in our culture. So they're feeling lonely in that way. But they probably also feel lonely because the general structure of things have changed so gravely. So I think there's just that level of discomfort with, like, where are those long conversations on the porch in the evening watching the sunset? Or how do I engage with somebody who doesn't know how to talk to me? Like, I want to pass on information to younger generations and they don't know how to talk to me, or we don't know how to bridge that gap, which I try to help with in my book. I try to give advice for, but
okay,
it's mainly the interpersonal stuff more than anything else. Yeah.
Well, and I also have to, being someone that I would quantify myself as a Xennial, you know, I think that before the digital age came around, you know, I kind of felt that life was, and more color, you know, the analog life, so to speak, was much more about just taking things in and not expecting everything now. It's more, you know, as hard as it is to believe, you actually got used to waiting for things to happen. and it was part of that wait that made you anticipate doing things that much more. Like, for example, simple movies that you knew would be coming out, simple video games that you knew would be coming out. I mean,
waiting for a TV show to premiere the next episode.
Exactly. Going from week to week and not necessarily having the ability to binge through, you know, certain series.
And the cool thing about that is that then the whole family would know this is coming out. And so you'd have a group of people wanting to watch it all at the same time.
Right. Right. And as much as we might be like, oh, that, you know, that was a pain in the rear to have to deal with all that stuff. You know, is it more of a pain in the rear? Do we have a trade-off now for having to deal with all the stuff that's constantly thrown at us for us to make all these, you know, these micro decisions that will count as decisions throughout your day and going towards the certain amount of decisions that you will make on a certain day, because I think there's like only a certain amount of energy that your brain can, you know, actually put towards making those decisions. That's one of the reasons why Steve Jobs, you know, the reason why he wore the same thing to work every day is because he didn't want to spend his mental energy thinking about such small things to him like that.
Exactly. We could maybe use, I mean, I don't want to put a stake in the ground and say like, rah, technology, but I think that the faucet analogy is a really good one, because I think, you know, maybe the faucet wasn't on as fully as we wanted it, but we had enough and we knew how to work our lives around that. And now, just like you alluded to, I really think it's like more like a fire hose and we're just like, oh God, there's so much all the time.
Exactly. Because I mean, the difference between going online right now and Googling an answer, you're looking up when does a movie come out, versus going down to you know, maybe the magazine shop or bookstore and getting a magazine and then reading upon, oh, so this is when this post, and then there's all these other stories that, you know, is related to that particular movie or whatever entertainment thing that you're going for. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you just don't have that kind of side discovery anymore as you once did. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not as noticeable, at least not to me. It's like, you want this thing? Here's this thing. You want this thing? Here's this thing.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of a la carte. But yeah, that being all said, what are you looking forward to in the rest of this year and getting this book out and
all that stuff? I am so just like I am trying not to rush through these days because this is kind of the moment I've been waiting for 3.5 years, but then also my whole life knowing that I wanted to be an author. And so I'm trying really hard to savor it. I am fingers crossed, knees crossed, toes crossed, everything crossed, that I will hear in October, mid-October, whether or not I will be speaking on the South by Southwest stage in 2019. About this work. So I believe that you can actually still go into the panel picker page. It's like Peter Piper picked a panel picker page and leave comments, which might help with the judging and voting. But the voting went well. So like I'm really optimistic about it. I'm waiting to hear back from Ted as well. So those are exciting. And then of course coming down to Indy, like I'm really excited to like see the spot where all the action takes place because I've heard so much about it. I think that's going to be really fun next month.
Yeah.
And then yeah, just, I mean that, but extrapolated the book signing, speaking about the book, hearing from what people think about the documentary, and maybe hopefully just hearing how, if anything, maybe this book can bring people joy because they're reading about, you know, these stories are beautiful, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no,
and
they
maybe,
are.
And maybe it'll change lives too. Maybe it'll make us a little bit more intentional. Because I do love technology. I ran a tech company, so I do love technology. I think it's very cool. But do we need it all? I don't think I need it all. I don't even own a microwave. Do you know that?
I'm surprised, actually. I would have thought that living in an apartment that almost guarantees that you would have.
Well, technically I live in a 120-year-old house that just happens to be a duplex. It was created as a duplex.
Oh, okay. Okay. Gotcha.
And so I just cook all my food in the oven. I play my music on a 1960s record player, but I have a Nest. I have a smartphone. I have my laptop. I have this really nifty mic that is like the super awesome compressionmic.com, you know? So like, it's funny, the intersections, but I think that comes with choice. And I think maybe we'll see more choice. And I think that would be really exciting.
Cool. Cool. Well, yeah. Looking to success in all those things and hoping to see you on the stages around the country. That would be so cool. And yeah, definitely looking forward to when you're down here with us. Moving on, our favorite part of the conversation that you actually get to answer these questions yourself. Rapid fire question time. First one.
Buckle in.
What are your three top favorite books you gift or tell others about?
Okay. The Success Principles by Jack Canfield, hands down, with regards to personal development. If you have a business, if you want to have a business, but generally, like if you're wondering, what do I do next? Who am I? What do I want? Read that book. It will take you a long time to read because it's broken into paragraphs. I mean, like there's two paragraphs on a page with little headers, and for some reason, each one will take you a day or two to process. So I love that book. Books that I recommend. Let me see. So for a fiction book, I love, love, love The Chrysalids. Let me think his name, John. You'll put it in the description. The Chrysalids, Chrysalids, or something like that. It is a post-apocalyptic fiction story that takes place probably in Canada, because if you go further south, they don't know what radiation is because it's been so long since. But we as readers know, oh, this is radiation. And there's taboos around mutations. And what I love about the book is that he plays with the idea of like, okay, high technology like what we have now doesn't exist anymore. What does that look like for generations to come who are trying to explain this? So there's stories of like, we used to be able to fly. No way. That's all, you know.
Have you heard of the current series called The 100?
Yes.
Yeah, that's definitely one of my favorite series right now.
Right.
And it's because you're looking at all these different factions of civilization, those who know that we have had technology. And then this is a post-apocalyptic show as well.
Yeah. It plays with that.
Yeah. And it talks, you know, there's the, some of the folks are called grounders that, you know, they only speak a little bit of English in their current language. Mm-hmm. And they're more, if anything, Native American. Mm-hmm. And they've gone back to that kind of living. I when you were talking about that book, I was just like, oh, wow, that's very similar. Mm-hmm. So cool.
Yeah. And I mean, then it calls into question, okay, we have these ancient civilizations who built things that we can't quite figure out how they did it. And it really brings home the point of like, we lose technology all the time. And and we shouldn't take stories like that and say they're myths out of hand just because we don't see the technology.
Now you sound like you're going to be an expert on ancient aliens.
No, I'm not. Although, I mean, to be honest, we don't know how to build a space shuttle like we used to. We've lost that technology already.
All right.
So, yeah, you know, yeah. So this is real. Okay. And then the last book to go straight into a different genre, let's say Dark Metropolis. It is the collected works of the artist Irving Norman. He is my favorite artist. And again, you know, can you tell I'm an anthropologist? He paints these paintings that are a little bit dark, but really grappling with like, what is society? What is it doing to us? You see these images of people smoking, they're on the subway, and they all look like sunken cheeks, very languid. And then the people whom he deems are rich are like sitting, like their bodies are all coins, and then their heads are hollow, and behind it is like a shriveled little head behind this like really beautiful face. And yeah, very thought-provoking indeed. Of course, I recommend my book as well, but you know, I don't think that I was allowed to throw that in there.
What's something that you've been learning about recently that you're excited to implement?
Well, yeah. So, well, I mean, with my book coming out right quick here, I have a vision of this book that's pretty long-term, because these stories are only going to become more important as our elders pass away. And so I really feel that universities and libraries are two institutions that really, should have it so that it can kind of become a legacy work. And so I've been learning a lot about like, what's that process like? How do I need to reach out, or do I reach out? And if I don't reach out, who needs to reach out? And it's a little bit jumping through hoops, but it's been educational.
One library that might have an interest in it is the Fort Wayne Library, since they have the largest genealogy collection and outside of Utah. Yeah.
Oh, neat. Thanks for that.
Yeah. If you could spend one day doing a job or running a business that you're currently not, what would it be?
I would be running a vineyard.
Vineyard.
Because that's nice. What I want to do. And I need to learn somehow. I haven't started amassing that knowledge yet. Like, I have on paper, but that's not the same thing. So to manage a vineyard for a day would be very useful and exciting.
Cool. Well, there's plenty of opportunities definitely around Michigan and Indiana. I'll tell you that much. We have so many vineyards anymore. It's, you know, just like craft brewing places.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I'm sure you'll be able to line that one up.
Yes. Once things settle down a little.
What happens regularly that would horrify a person from 100 years ago?
I mean, honestly, an adult 100 years ago, so that this generation, that's the generation before the greatest generation, electricity. They're so scared of it. They're so scared of it that they wouldn't go into buildings that were electrified because they were scared the electricity would jump out the sockets. So, I mean, yeah, electricity.
Yeah. This is so commonplace anymore. That people are like, are we damaging our brains because of all electricity? That's
right. But that puts into perspective now, like, our parents and then maybe some in our generation are nervous about autonomous vehicles and then what comes next after that and next after that. And those are going to be normalized just like electricity was.
Oh, and CEOs of large companies smoking marijuana and on podcasts.
Yes.
How can someone be a difference maker in their community?
Listen and take action. Your community needs something different than my community. So I can't tell you what your community needs or what to do. But there are people who are really willing to tell you if you ask. And they will be so thankful that you asked. And then all you have to do then is take their advice or go to the organization they suggested or find an organization that serves the purpose that they said this is a need. So just listen and then go do.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Veronica, thank you so much for spending some time with me today. And I know that we do this pretty regularly, but hey, just you were on a different seat. If people want to find out more about your book, they can go to storiesofelders.com. Mm-hmm. And where can people find you on the socials?
I can be found on any social media platform using the handle V as in Victor, M as in Marie, and Kirin, my last name, K-I-R-I-N. Just like that Japanese beer that I am not Japanese, so it's very interesting.
Oh, great relationship. All right. Well, again, thank you so much, and it's been fun.
Thank you.
So there you all have it. You know, I'm so really glad to have the opportunity to speak with Veronica about, you know, an entire journey and what she's been up to really the last couple of 3 years. And, you know, as I said in the conversation, I've had the opportunity to learn about my own ancestors through genealogy. However, you know, they weren't, especially my grandparents, weren't really around for me to actually get to know more about their lives as an adult. And there's just something about the past that I love learning about, especially when we can relate to it. And really, I mean, that's one of the reasons I love this book. It's a cross between two topics that I often think about myself. You know, the past, how things used to be, and where we're going in the future. Today's show note extras, I'm including a couple of interviews relating to the book itself. And I'm also going to include a couple of videos that relate to the work that Veronica does in her business. But that said, guys, that's it for session 132. Thank you for spending a little bit of time with us today. Hope you had a good time and we were able to give you a little bit of value. The next session is one to look forward to as it's with a fan of the show. His name is Dom Brightman, and he started his podcast Going North after releasing his first book of the same name. And in our chat with Dominique, Veronica and I find out how he became a speaker at a relatively early age, what motivated him to write his first book in his 20s, and what he's learned in the past year as a podcast host. Until then, don't forget to get started with Fizzle today. For only $35 a month, you can get courses, coaching, community, and now WordPress optimized hosting as a member. Get your first month free at newinceptions.com/fizzle. Thanks for joining Veronica and me today. Until next session, dig in, have fun, and take care on whatever you're creating, and we'll see you back here next time.
Thanks for listening to the Angles of Latitude podcast. Connect with us at home, at work, or on the go at facebook.com/newinceptions, on Twitter at newinceptions, Instagram at new.inceptions, and on the web at newinceptions.com.